Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Over the past few weeks, politicians should have been coming together in cities across the country for their annual party conferences. But it's been somewhat different this year, with the pandemic meaning that conference events, speeches and debates have had to move online. Despite this, I caught up with four politicians representing the two main parties to discuss how the pandemic was affecting the economies of cities and towns across the country, whether the levelling up agenda was gaining or waning in importance, and to get a sense from them what they think the future holds for cities and towns up and down the country. In this episode, I'm joined by Bridget Phillipson, Labour MP for Houghton and Sunderland South and Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury. Councillor Abby Brown, leader of Stoke-on-Trent City Council, one of the largest Conservative-run cities in the UK. Councillor Peter Lamb, Labour leader of Crawley, which we at the Centre for Cities identified earlier this year as a place likely to be most badly affected by COVID-19. And finally, I'm joined by Ben Bradley, who was elected Conservative MP for Mansfield in 2017 and was one of the first of the party's MPs in the formerly red but now blue wall. So first up, to get Labour's take on the levelling up agenda, in particular the role of cities in delivering it, I'm joined by Bridget Phillipson, who, as I've just said, is the Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury in the Shadow Cabinet. Hello, Bridget.
Hello, good to be with you.
So let's start with Labour's position on the levelling up agenda. And what is it? I mean, how would you define and set out Labour's position?
I mean, we clearly face big regional inequalities entrenched for some time, and that applies whether it's in terms of skills or health inequalities. There are, you know, lots of problems in our country to address. I suppose what's less clear to me is what is meant when we talk about levelling up and what the government intends around that. You know, we haven't seen a strategy for what levelling up means, or perhaps tests set around what we'd be hoping would be changed as a result of this agenda that the government's been keen to push. You know, are we talking about people or productivity perhaps, or incomes, living standards? It's never been entirely clear to me what the government is seeking to achieve when it says they want to level up the country beyond a slogan.
So in that sense, but so you recognise and you would agree with the principle that, as we well know, you know, the UK has, you know, quite stark differentials when we look particularly across different parts of the country. It's not exclusively a north-south conversation, but there are elements of that in there. So you kind of recognise the problem and the issue. I mean, from your point of view, of and obviously thinking about it as the Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury, you know, where would you begin to think about trying to bottom up what levelling up means?
I mean, it's undeniable that we do face, as you say, very stark differences across the country. And I think you're right, it's not simply a north-south question or even London versus the rest, which is sometimes, I think, where that discussion unhelpfully takes us, as if London somehow didn't have problems around health inequality or child poverty, as my community does too. But I think when you look at what's happened over the last decade, we've seen a widening of some of those gaps, further opening up. You know, we've had 10 years of one party primarily in charge, and that has, I believe, entrenched some of that inequality further. I think when we talk about levelling up, it often takes us to a discussion around transport and infrastructure, and of course that is important, and I would say that, again, over the course of the last 10 years, my part of the world in the northeast of England hasn't had its fair share of investment in infrastructure or transport. But I think primarily the issue is fundamentally one of skills and investment in people as much as in the bricks and mortar. And I think that is perhaps an even greater challenge than the transport problem that we have. Even if we were to see large scale investment in transport infrastructure, that wouldn't resolve in and of itself those big skills gaps that exist. And that is something that businesses tell me all the time remains a major problem for them, both in recruiting to jobs, but also in creating new jobs too. Transport would help with some of that. It would make it easier, but I don't think it's entirely the answer.
No, well, I mean, a lot of our work completely echoes and reinforces, you know, your points there, as I said, it tends to tends to, I think, too much on the, as on the physical infrastructure side and not enough on the people side. I definitely agree with that. Obviously, you know, we're talking in late September. We've had the COVID situation for the last 6 months, if not slightly longer. How has that affected your thinking and the, you know, the party's thinking in terms of this space and this agenda?
I think it's an opportunity for us all to reflect on the kind of country that we live in and the kind of country that we want to build. I think, however, it would be a mistake to then just say it reinforces beliefs that I've always held. I don't think we can fully yet appreciate the change that will be taking place both within our economy and in our society as a result of this terrible time that we've been living through as a country. I mean, in my community, you know, we've seen people pull together with incredible resilience, and that's been just remarkable to see how much people have been looking out for one another during this time. But we've also, I think, begun to see the opening up of those long-standing pressures that already exist, where I really do fear that because of the inadequate offer that I think was put forward through the Chancellor's winter economic plan, we will see large-scale unemployment once again. The Chancellor will say, of course, that, you know, some jobs are no longer viable without seeking to define exactly what it is he means by that. But that also goes at the same time as many sectors of our economy being unable to open at all or opening at much greatly reduced capacity. And they will be viable in the future, and they're central to our country's recovery and to the kind of strategic industries that we'll need in order to come through this crisis. So I think it's a really challenging time for the country. It's not entirely clear what the regional impact of COVID will be, whether it's felt more keenly in some parts of the country over others. But I am particularly concerned about making sure that we do everything we can to protect our kind of strategic capacity as a country, whether that's through manufacturing and exports, because once that's lost and once those skills and those workers have lost their jobs, it will be harder to get that back.
And that's hinting at a sort of trying to understand, you know, the relative value that different bits of the economy play in the kind of longer term as well as in the short run term. I mean, similarly, you know, we try to think about, you know, exporting activity as having a slightly different contribution than maybe kind of local services activity. It's not to place different worths on them in the sense of the roles that people do, but actually just in a strategic sense. Is that where your thinking is now in trying to differentiate so we can have a better understanding as to what bits of the economy might need to be supported for slightly longer in terms of the value that they bring in?
I think we do need to recognise the differences in impact on different sectors of our economy. Some sectors have been hit harder than others and will be for longer. That's undeniable. The government has been quite reluctant, I think, to consider sectoral interventions. They have in some areas, of course. I mean, some of what they brought forward, even in the winter economic plan, did recognise that, you know, for example, hospitality will be more greatly affected. But we haven't seen that broader industrial strategy, I think we will need to see brought forward. We were obviously long overdue the government's response to the National Infrastructure Commission, so those longer term challenges that we face as a country. But what was also absent from the Chancellor's plan was any meaningful strategy around retraining for workers who do lose their jobs and what happens next. So if we want, if whether or not we, you know, we want to see a transition to a different kind of economy, you know, government has a role in shaping what that recovery and what that transition could look like. But if the government simply says that some people will lose their jobs and doesn't put anything in place to smooth that path, then we do risk, I think, that long-term scarring and damage that comes with people being out of work for prolonged periods. And even going into this crisis, you know, in my region, the Northeast, we had above average levels of unemployment. We go from being, you know, at the top to amongst the top in terms of levels of unemployment. So we already have that built-in problem. And then to add into that, lots of people who may now have already been out of work for some months, plus those who are likely to lose their jobs in the months ahead, I do think we need to see that kind of funding brought forward around skills in order to make that as easy as possible for people to move into different areas of work if they have lost their job during this crisis.
And in that sort of space, Bridget, where are you in terms of, you know, the relevant role and relationships between, say, you know, central government on the one hand and local government on the other, or at least, you know, how do you envisage and the Labour Party envisage those two relevant parties kind of working together, and, you know, the different roles and responsibilities they've got? Because, you know, as you know, it kind of, you know, over the last X number of years, that's waxed and waned. Some have been very strongly in favour of devolution, others or and more of a role for local government, other bits, you know, less so. So, I mean, just where is the Labour Party currently on those sorts of issues?
I don't think we've made best use of our local councils during the crisis, whether it's through, you know, testing or contact tracing. And also they've faced, you know, major funding pressures in responding to the desperate situation facing many people who rely on their councils at that kind of time of need. I think, you know, looking to the future, there is clearly a role for councils and for local business in shaping the labour market and in providing that those kinds of opportunities around training and education. They will often know their labour market and local conditions exceptionally well. They'll often have good relationships established with local providers with further education. Again, an area that's had a real hollowing out in the last 10 years that's then, I think, already made it harder for people to go back to education and to reskill that second chance that so many people often depend on. I think there are straightforward areas in which powers could be further devolved to a more local level, but I don't believe, however, that devolution is the answer in and of itself. I don't think it provides that silver bullet, and it's part of a picture, but I also believe that there is clearly a role for government in creating the kind of framework and necessary conditions in order for all communities right across the country to thrive into the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I think you're right in a sense that, you know, there is, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, there is no sort of magic bullet or silver bullet out there. But I'm interested in, if I can sort of characterise, you know, the previous Labour leadership, I think, was much more into a kind of central government, big state approach, things organised from the centre. And yes, there was a role for local government, but it was very tightly constrained within that national sort of setting. Is it your sense that, you know, the current leadership now is kind of reassessing the relative role and relationship between, you know, the local and the central, and, you know, figuring out the best way to, that we can get the best out of both? Is that where you think you are?
I think where we've got to now in terms of how devolution is working across England is that it's a rather uneven picture that hasn't been part of a longer term view around the role of those devolved institutions and local government. It's all a bit of a mess, and I think it needs some coherence brought to it. So I think that would be one important aspect of any plans we'd be looking at around looking at the landscape as it is now and whether it works. I've always been of the view that what local people care about most is the outcomes that are achieved rather than the level of that decision making. Now, sometimes that decision making can be best done at a local level, sometimes it isn't. I think we look to the outcomes that we want to achieve and we work back from there rather than predetermining that a decision must be taken at national or local level. I think it's about getting the most effective outcomes, whether that's in reducing child poverty, where I think there is clearly a big role for central government over and above local institutions, important though they might be in certain aspects of skills policy. Primarily, child poverty is an issue of income above all else. But in where it comes to transport, say, I think there is very straightforwardly a case for greater devolution of transport powers, particularly where it comes to bus services, that wouldn't require additional spending by government, but actually is a question of using what we're spending better and more effectively in order to provide a more joined up local network where actually residents have a greater say over how public money is being spent, existing public money that's already being spent and actually not being spent well at all.
Yeah. And just the sort of, you know, reflections on, you know, going back to where we started, really, obviously you're, you know, Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury portfolio, you know, covers a wide range of economy related issues. I mean, just how prominent is the thinking around or the need to address this sort of geographical inequality that we see across lots of different fronts that you've just been talking about? I mean, how central is that to the wider view of how the economy functions or how it would function you know, if we had a Labour government?
I mean, as I said earlier, it's very hard to know where the next few years will take us. I mean, it does look like we're on course for a slower recovery, partly as a result of the fact that our test, track and isolate system is working so inadequately, and it's making it harder for the economy to return to any degree of normality. So much will rest on the shape of that economy in the run-up to 2024, and you know, we'll go through a process of determining what our policies will be when we've got a much clearer sense of the likely shape of the economy closer to that point. But I think what is clear is that we do need to move towards a greener economy, one that's more sustainable, that's fairer, that makes sure that wherever you're from, into whichever family you're born, you have every opportunity to get on in life. And that isn't the situation we face right now as a country. You know, I meet so many incredibly talented young people in my community who I think are too often denied the opportunities that they deserve. And there's a major challenge there around making sure that we have a much fairer country. And I fear that the crisis we're living through now will make that task harder still and will entrench some of those already deep-seated inequalities within our society.
Excellent. Bridget, thank you very much for taking time out of a busy schedule to have a conversation with us. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much.
Next up, I'm joined by Councillor Abby Brown, leader of Stoke-on-Trent City Council. Welcome back, Abby, actually, because it was 12 months ago at Conservative Party conference that we had a chat about what Stoke was up to and the big devolution agenda and all of that. So welcome back.
No, thank you. It's nice to be back. I'm in Stoke and you're wherever you are, and we're not, as you say, in a hotel drinking warm wine.
Indeed not. We can be thankful for some small mercies, at least on that front. So obviously 12 months, a lot has happened, to put it mildly. Let's start off with just give us a sense as to, you know, what's been happening in Stoke over the last 12 months, and particularly, I suppose, you know, since the early part of the year when the pandemic came and then obviously lockdown resulted. I mean, what's been happening in Stoke? How has the economy fared?
I would clearly say the economy in Stoke-on-Trent has done reasonably well. We've been really pleased, actually. The data from Centre for Cities in the last couple of weeks has showed that we are back to 95% footfall within our city centre and 100% of spend, which clearly demonstrates, you know, that the economy in the city is fairly robust. And one of the arguments, you know, I've been keen to make is that actually the future of the UK economy is really soundly based on medium-sized cities like Stoke-on-Trent. The second best performing city within the wider East West Midlands is Derby, again, similar size to Stoke-on-Trent, similar sort of economy. So I think from that point of view, obviously really pleased and very confident. We've continued to work hard, number of deals that we continue to work on with investors who want to come to the city and businesses that are coming and locating here. But I think, you know, there's a focus then, isn't there, in terms of what happens around recovery and also the immediate things. So, you know, one thing very much that's concerning me today, might not be in a week's time, who knows, is around the 10 p.m. curfew. Stoke-on-Trent in recent years, particularly our city centre, has had a big growth around independent food and beverage offer. And, you know, they're struggling. 10 p.m. curfew is not great if you are running a little craft beer bar. And actually, that is what the resurgence of the city has been based on, small independents who've been doing something different. And we have a real conglomeration of those in the city centre. And I'm worried about them because actually lockdown meant that they diversified. We had some really fantastic things that started to appear. You know, for me, I had my tea one night from a bistro that did dine in out. I had to go and fetch my meals, and they all came with instructions on the top of how to cook them. But that's really good, isn't it? You know, that really appeals. But you think, you know, they've opened as a bistro and they're going to have to close at 10. So, you know, their kitchen maybe closes at 8:30, 9:00, or theatre isn't open. You know, so I think for me, that's a worry. What happens to businesses like that moving forward when actually we are seeing that people are back very quickly into our city centre and they are spending money?
Yeah, and that's a great reminder of the sense of, you know, our cities are obviously places where, you know, work happens, but also they're a place where people like to socialise And obviously that has an employment implication, but actually people like being in cities because of the amenities, because of the offer, and we need to be mindful about them, particularly as they continue to, you know, to struggle because of, as you say, because of some of the restrictions that are in place as a result of the virus. In terms of the council and what you know, how you've been supporting people and firms to cope and to begin to recover, I mean what's the council itself been up to, both obviously in its own right, but then with, you know, with partners as well?
Well, I think we've done all the things that, you know, all the other councils have done in terms of distributing the business support grants. And, you know, I know we won't be alone in having done things like sent teams out to knock on doors, to actually physically speak to people and say, you know, we've sent you this letter, have you applied? And, I spoke to a number of businesses about this who thought it wouldn't be relevant for them. So I think there's a huge amount of effort for all councils in terms of saying to people, this what is for you, please have a look. So you kind of go from all the things like that right the way through for us, certainly as a city, doing one of the things that I like to feel that I do best, which is talking about my city and talking it up and talking about things that have happened. So this week we've got a 4-star Hilton hotel opening in the city. It's been under construction for several years, and you know, people are familiar with that. But as always happens, whether you're in a pandemic or not, as you get close to the opening phase, you want to talk about it more. So I've done quite a lot of talking about what's happening. We've got the Hilton opening shortly. We also have a city centre living offer that is about to complete in the next couple of weeks that's been built by the council's housing company. And we've been talking about that because clearly we want people to move in. But actually, we've been really pleased about the level of interest there. Over 50% of the apartments have now been let. And, you know, I think we only carried out real life viewings for about a week. The rest have been virtual, which I think, again, is really interesting. But, a wider offer, again, growing sector for us as a city is people coming and visiting. You know, Stoke-on-Trent is one of those places people come and visit and they often say to me, I never knew it was going to be like this. It's actually quite nice, isn't it? And they go, yeah, it is. So we decided this summer we would have, a campaign to encourage people to go on a Stokecation. So we spent a lot of time talking about Stokecation, and our target audience was people who live in the city and people who live up to an hour away.
Yeah.
You know, because actually, I think we have over 5 million visitors a year, of which a relatively small percentage stay overnight, hence why I need a Hilton hotel. But actually, for those who do come for a day, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, come and have a look at Stoke. You know, go and enjoy our parks, go to some of the attractions, just come and try something different. And we think that's been fairly successful, and we're kind of continuing that theme on by, trying to do things in a virtual way that encourage people to safely come back to the city and enjoy our attractions. So for me, a big part of getting the economy going has been continuing to remind people about how brilliant my city is and the great things that we're doing.
Fantastic. Well, you know, that is definitely one of the things that, you know, you always hope for. I'm always pleased when you see, you know, the leaders of places being, you know, passionate advocates for their place, you know, not just with, you know, in the general sense, as well as, you know, when they're talking to government or to investors. So it's fantastic to hear that. Just turning to, I suppose, to the wider agenda, obviously, you know, Stoke in the Midlands, you know, a forerunner in some respects, a pioneer for, you know, what's now used to, you know, term the blue wall and all of that sort of stuff, which is central to the government's thinking about levelling up. I mean, just how do you see that playing out? I mean, what's been happening in relation to, you know, to the levelling up agenda as you understand it from the government, and where does Stoke fit into that?
Well, I'm pleased about your comment about us being, you know, as I would describe, one of the first bricks in the red wall, obviously, taking the Stoke South seat in 2017, hot on the heels of having kind of taken partial control of the council. And of course, you know, today it's really exciting, very different for me to be a Conservative leader of a council with 3 Conservative MPs, and the agenda has completely shifted. I think, you know, probably, you know, I like to pride myself on telling the truth rather than saying what I'm told to say. And I think there's probably an element for me of a little bit of confusion and dissatisfaction at times in terms of where we do go around levelling up. However, you know, I think the pandemic has given us an opportunity to reinforce that. And certainly the fallout from the recent issues around local government reorganisation have given us, certainly for me as a leader of a unitary authority, the ability to restate my position, you know, in terms of you know, my council is perfectly sized as far as I'm concerned, yeah. and I'm happy to work with all different sorts of people and different colleagues from different councils around getting the best for my residents and for theirs. And really, local government reorganisation is a bit of a distraction. So my sense is from the ministers that I've spoken to over the last few weeks that there has been a bit of a moment of realisation from their part that, you know, some of the bigger deals are really great. And, you know, I'm not somebody who likes to think that I'm jealous of other places. I don't look at other places and go, I wish I had a West Midlands deal or stuff like that. But I do look at it sometimes and I think, well, why are you looking at such big geographies? You know, what's wrong with smaller places and doing things a bit differently? And my sense is that the government are starting to refocus a bit on that.
And is that because do you think, you know, that the party or the government, you know, is less familiar with places like yours than it is maybe with others? And so they apply one idea to other places. I'm curious about, you know, that. And so the significance, I suppose, of places like Stoke in a conservative sort of philosophy versus, you know, I suppose a Labour philosophy, which would be much more, you know, natural home, not a natural home, but a traditional home for places like yours. I mean, how does that play out?
Well, I'd like to think it's because I'm really noisy. That I unashamedly say what I think. And I think I'm probably not alone in that. You know, there's a few other of my colleagues in other places that are unexpectedly blue. And I would probably point at my colleague, David in Bolton, who's also said things that have been quite controversial over the last few weeks in terms of the lockdown. And I think actually that, you know, I don't think Boris Johnson goes, wonder what Abby Brown's doing today in Stoke-on-Trent. But I do think actually there is an element that when somebody like me, who's got to where I've got to, is generally trying to follow make the best of the things the government give to me, enterprise owners and things like that, but then suddenly says, actually, this is a bit of a mess, isn't it? Come on, sort yourselves out. That maybe that carries more weight than people who just toe the line all the time. Yeah. I guess a rebellious Tory kind of approach. And I think, again, there is, as you say, that element perhaps that because we haven't as a party been necessarily terribly successful in bigger cities, that suddenly now we are, that there is a need to kind of refocus back on that. And that does give people like me actually a bit of a platform. You know, Stoke's not a huge city, 30th largest in the UK, but actually I don't think there's a bigger city than Stoke that's got a Tory leader. So suddenly, yeah. And particularly have one, I guess, you know, with a small bit of profile and who probably doesn't fit the description of what somebody would be expecting of a Conservative leader in the city, suddenly means that maybe when I am a bit controversial, maybe they listen to me a bit more.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic, and it's a really interesting sort of dynamic, you know, as political parties, which are always sort of broad, you know, broad churches on the one hand, but actually, you know, some of your more urban colleagues, yourself and obviously others, and the influence they have then on you know, on national government as it is, because of it's a Conservative government, in the way that they think about issues like levelling up or devolution, I think, rather than naturally, traditionally often thinking about, you know, coming at it from a Shire County perspective, which is classically, you know, where they would often start.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of it is probably also about the focus of talking about things that are not natural territory for us. One of the things that I've spent a lot of time being involved with, not just over the last 6 to 7 months, but actually since I've become leader of the council, is homelessness. You know, it's a big agenda in all cities, but through local circumstance, I've been quite involved with one of our local homeless centres and on their journey. Now, it's probably an added advantage that the homeless centre happens to be led by Lou Macari, who will be well known to anybody who is familiar with.
Yes, I know. Yes, indeed.
You know, my involvement with Lou and what the Macari Foundation do has been really eye-opening for me, but it's also been really empowering in terms of how you move the agenda on and how you can work with people and work with organisations and work with the government too to do really good stuff. And I think there is a kind of, that's a bit of a sea change for me, I suspect, in that that's not necessarily where people expect Tory leaders to be, yeah, in the home, yeah, centre.
So that's a great example of kind of making it, you know, making it real, because I suppose one of the, you know, interesting your thoughts, what, you know, one of the sort of concerns, I guess, you hear is, you know, how does the government make, you know, the warm words around and the aspirations about levelling up, how do you make that real? How do you land that in places like Stoke? But actually, how do you make it relevant for, you know, for the people of Stoke, or, you know, the people of Bolton, you know, or the people of Mansfield, you know, wherever it might be. But, you know, how do you make it real for, you know, beyond these kind of warm words and grand aspirations?
And I think part of that is suddenly about talking about it, isn't it? And not being afraid to talk about it. And at times for me to say, I'm not happy with what the government does. I think, to be honest, broadly on homelessness, I think we've had a huge amount of support, and I've been really pleased with the conversations I've had. I think, you know, we've got a new minister, Kelly Tolhurst, who I know from her days in Bays. And I think, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what Kelly's approach is to this, as somebody who is very down to earth. But I think, you know, we need, as you say, to be connecting those real life issues to the government, to ask them what they're going to do about them. And, you know, similarly, around issues, you know, one of my MPs is very passionate about food poverty, kind of how does that fit in? And obviously that's something actually as a local authority, as all local authorities, we've actually been quite close to over the last 6 months in terms of delivering food parcels. So where does that go to? You know, and how do we join that up? And particularly, you know, with other things, we've seen as an authority a huge increase in demand for allotments. Well, where does that tie in?
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough to be talking to the Secretary of State the other day, and I was saying to him, you know, where I am as a local authority leader is that there's no threat to my ambition. It's still massive. My challenge is that I don't have the workforce and I don't have the revenue funding to do those very basic putting together of plans to come with you.
Yeah.
And I can't afford any longer for you to say, we've got this brilliant competition, have a bid for it, and you might get something. You know, I'm not in that space. What I want to know is...
And so would you, you know, over the next sort of, I don't know, over the next 12 months or so, I mean, is that something that you're, you know, you're pressing government for and expecting them to respond, which is, for example, you know, local government funding, you know, just in terms of the amount of money that you get? Obviously, that's a significant issue given income has probably dropped and, you know, outgoings have gone up over the last 6 to 8 months, obviously. But it's a kind of totality or amount question, but also, you know, the conditions upon which you get it, you know, lots more freedom, flexibility to do the things that you, you know, that you regard and have been told is locally important. Is that one area that, you are pushing the government to do more on?
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, most listeners to this, if they're certainly involved in local government, you know, are very kind of aware that as a unitary authority, you're in a kind of different place, because you might want to have a conversation about devolution, but actually you might feel like me, which is actually I'm perfectly capable of doing this without any kind of extra special reorganisation or stuff like that. It's just that I simply don't have the scale any longer to be able to do it. So it's kind of saying to the government, we've had elements of devolution that I'd like to extend. I am unashamedly a massive fan of enterprise zones, because I've got one and it's been really good for us and we would like to see that extended. But also I want to explore how I can work better around transport with my district neighbours without actually having to do something else. Why can't you just accept that actually we can work together and then push around that in terms of how the government supports that and what opportunities there are there? You know, I think it sends a really strong message to the public when they see local authority leaders talking about basic stuff like transport.
Yeah.
But actually, I don't see why it has to be so complicated. Why can't it just be that I talk to my fellow leaders and we do stuff?
Yeah. And are you, I suppose, your final reflections, are you hopeful that, you know, the government is clearly listening? You know, you've already said you kind of, you know, regularly in conversation with them and, you know, helping them understand places like Stoke and what they need. You know, are you optimistic and hopeful that, you know, they'll do more than listen, that they will respond over, you know, whether it's through the, you know, the spending review, whatever that looks like, or whether that's through, the various white papers that are, you know, out for consultation or are promised? I mean, are you hopeful?
I'm more hopeful now than I probably was a few months ago. I think the discussion, certainly in local government, about reorganisation has moved on a bit. And for me, it is about, I'm going to say this clearly, it is about leaders like me. It's not about districts versus counties falling out over things and trying to develop what looks to me often to be a one size fits all. You know, it can only be a county unitary. Well, I'm not interested in any of that. I just want to do the best for Stoke-on-Trent. But I think there was also possibly a realisation from the government, and certainly over the last, I would say, a couple of months, that the way things have gone, you know, is that people are looking to the government to show leadership. And they're looking to see how that then cascades down to local leaders like myself, who have been, you know, had a very high profile, I guess, probably over the last 6 months. And they're wanting to know why that isn't joining up. And my sense is that the government is kind of a bit more aware of that, that to build their credibility. And you know, as I say, unashamedly, not that they ever let me near the Prime Minister, but when I get near any minister, I say, don't forget, you know, the Prime Minister isn't in number 10 without the support of three MPs from Stoke-on-Trent. So if you want, and if you want to continue to be a number 10, then you need to ensure there's three MPs from Stoke-on-Trent, and you need to ensure there's a Conservative leader of the council who helped them to get there too. So, you know, what are you going to do for me in exchange for that? And I think that message is starting to get a bit more traction now, because the clock is ticking, isn't it? The clock is ticking for me for my next election, and there won't be long after my next election until my MPs will be up for election. And I think, you know, there is also a sense, I think, that the relationship I have with my MPs and us working together, the Stoke-on-Trent mafia, is equally reflected in other places where, you know, we see further north, MPs are talking to their councils about what you do together.
Yeah.
Councils are the delivery arm of the government, aren't we, in effect?
Yeah.
We're going to be I'm going to be the person who delivers these things. It isn't Boris Johnson who improves transport in Stoke-on-Trent. It's Abby Brown at Stoke-on-Trent City Council with her MPs.
Yeah.
And I think that message is getting through.
Now, that is a great point, and a great point to finish. Abby, as always, it's brilliant talking to you. So thank you very much for spending a bit of time with us. Much appreciated. No. Next, I'm joined by Councillor Peter Lamb, who is the leader of Crawley Borough Council. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to look at how Crawley's been affected by the pandemic and then the lockdown, and obviously what your thoughts are for the future. But can you just start with really just paint a little picture of what the Crawley economy looks like, and particularly pre-COVID, in a sense, how would you describe the Crawley economy before the pandemic came along?
Crawley has had a very long period of sort of high employment, going really back to when it was set up as a new town in the 1940s. When it was set up, large industries moved out of London with their entire workforces, and gradually as those businesses changed or shut down, because a lot of it was light industry and was lost over the decades, the growth of Gatwick provided new economic opportunities. So we've always had high employment as a local area, and certainly I know, you know, the kids at school, certainly they get to about year 8, year 9, and quite often the boys would stop making a significant effort because they knew they could always get a job up at the airport. We've undergone significant growth over recent years. Since 2013 through to 2019, we saw about a 23%, 24% increase in the size of our local economy. And despite only being 2% of the land mass of West Sussex, we generate there's well over a quarter of total economic activity. So a real sort of booming economy, or at least it was up until earlier in this year.
Yeah, so I mean, that takes us nicely to, can you just tell us, you know, what the effect of the pandemic was, I suppose, in the initial phases, and then, you know, as lockdown was introduced, and then obviously lockdown was just eased. Can you sort of paint a picture of how that's played out in your patch?
I mean, a lot of the employment in the town has some connection with the airport. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone is working at the airport or for an airline, but when you look at all the different economies and the supply chains that feed into it, you know, including sort of, you know, taxi drivers, for instance, logistics. It has an enormous impact on the footprint of local economy. And so with the shutting down of air routes, you know, the eventual lockdown of airports, there was a drastic impact in terms of the amount of money coming into the local area. Gatwick got to the point where it was losing £1 million per day, just keeping operations going, even with a reduced workforce. And we have seen significant numbers of people go to furlough or to self-employed support scheme. We actually first got our sort of warning of that for a Centre of Cities report, which had highlighted it was going to risk. Our numbers in the end weren't quite as bad. It was about 40% of the town that was either furloughed on the self-employment support scheme or on universal credit. And as time has gone on, we've seen the percentage on universal credit tick up and up as employers have been forced to take decisions due to the lack of support that's out there, really. I mean, we got quite hard hit with lack of support from the government at the start, on the basis that most of our businesses are quite big and all the support was targeted to small businesses. So we got less than half of what our neighbours, whose economies are a fraction of our size, did to help prop up our local workforce. And that has had a lasting impact, really.
And how is looking at the council itself, how has the sort of pandemic affected, you know, income and expenditure? Obviously, this is an ongoing, you know, income shrunk, I presume, and expenditure, you know, gone up for a variety of reasons. But can you just paint the picture of, you know, how that's affected the council itself?
Sure. I mean, you know, while a lot of our sort of individual economic circumstances are based around the airport and are going to be quite unique to us, although having an enormous impact, you know, the income and expenditure is going to be the same for most like authorities. We have over the years seen our grants drop essentially to zero, central government, and so most district councils, most of our income now comes through, or much of it comes through local generations. That's either going to be through council tax, through retained business rates, or through what we can make ourselves. And certainly as a local authority, we've made a big impact to avoid having making any cuts. In fact, I became leader in 2014, and the budget we set last February was still spending the same amount of money as back then, despite the cuts to our grant, because we've worked so hard to find new sources of income generation. Now, like everyone else, you shut down the economy and all of a sudden that money stops coming in. So all that, the income generation efforts we've made collapsed. But then when you look at what's happened to the way in which local government finance has been redesigned over the last 10 years, and this was predicted at the time, it would have this impact. When you go into any sort of economic recession, you're going to have local authorities with less spending power than ever before to try and do anything to try and prop it up. So in Crawley's case, because we have an enormous economy, we were collecting about £120 million worth of business rates. We were getting about £4 million of that, and that was under a scheme the government called 100% business rent protection, which tells you how much you need to know about trusting government financing schemes. But because of what's happened and because of it being based on projected economic growth, we are now in the safety net. So we've essentially lost £2 million because we can't collect in at the rate we're supposed to collect in straight off. And then when you look at what's happening with council tax, you see the better part of 40% of the town going unemployed over the next few years. That's going to demolish our council tax base. There's going to be so few people paying into it on our current business rates, on our current council tax benefit arrangements, which means that like most councils, we're going to have to cut our current council tax benefit scheme, because the government devolved that 10 years ago and gave them a fraction of the money it would cost to run the scheme fully. And without rebasing that, we're going to be in a position where we are going to have to make it a much, much less generous scheme, which means that people who won't be able to cover their bills anywhere are now going to have to pay part of the council tax as well. It's not just going to us, so it's not just something we can decide for ourselves. It goes to county council, goes to the local police force. Which means that we're essentially taking money out of the pockets of people whose incomes are incredibly very low. And then, as anyone knows from any form of economics around recessions, you want to be putting more money into people with the lowest incomes because they're going to spend it in the local economy, and that's going to promote economic growth. So really everything around what's happening right now with local government finance is designed to create the maximum damage to local economies.
And so obviously, that, I mean, as you alluded there, you know, the scale of the effects are enormous, and in part worsened, as you say, in your locality, because of the scale of Gatwick and its, you know, all of its sort of web of interactions, and then obviously the effect that it's had on Gatwick, effectively closing it. I mean, not quite, but very very near to that. I mean, what's the council been trying to do in terms of, what has it been doing, you know, on its own or with its partners to try and help people and firms sort of cope with the immediate effects of the pandemic and then the lockdown? And then I suppose as it's begun to open up, you know, how have you tried to introduce, you know, or support that slow and easing of the lockdown?
Well, we set up an economic recovery task force at the start, and that's got representatives from all the major local economic organisations. So we've got two bids in the town. We've got we're members of a range of large organisations, members of a city deal with Brighton City Deal and the LEP, and we've got a whole host of large businesses that are sitting on that board. But let's be realistic about this. You know, there's very limited amounts that a local council with £14 million worth of net revenue expenditure can do with an airport. It's losing £1 million a day. And, you know, we have got plans in place around trying to improve skills. I get told I'm too negative about this. I just try and be honest with people. Yep. I'm not going to set false expectations. We're investing in skills. We're trying to get a university presence in. We have got a significant amount of effort going into trying to pair people up with employment. But if 40% of the town are unemployed, how many people can you redeploy elsewhere in the economy? You know, we're looking at growth in terms of the future sort of green jobs. We're looking at improving connectivity in terms of digital connectivity to try and compete. But, you know, all of this is you know, it's got a long time delay attached to it. And we know that aviation in time should recover. So really what's happening is for the next 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, a large 10% of my town's population have been thrown on the scrap heap on the basis of the fact the government will be the only government in Europe not to have a targeted deal for the aviation sector. In fact, pretty much one of the only modern sort of high sort of level of economic countries in the world that hasn't got a deal. And they can't really provide a clear explanation why that is the case.
And so just going on to that, I mean, obviously you've got we've got issues around the scale and nature of the problem in your locality and, you know, the government's, as you say, inability or unwillingness to respond through the aviation industry or the sector responses, which is particular to Crawley. But I mean, general reflections on, I mean, obviously you also said, you know, up to 40% of the workforce at some point in time on the furlough scheme, which is now obviously tapering. We've had the job support scheme as the announcement to you know, to come on board shortly. But just your sort of general reflections on, you know, the economic responses that you've seen from the government. You know, is it adequate? Is it enough? You know, what more needs to, what would you like to see happen in addition to what's already been announced?
Has it been enough? No, not really. It's been very poorly targeted. You know, if you talk to people who work for HMRC, they'll tell you about the levels of fraud that's been in the system, which was predictable because there are no real checks put in place at the time. We were told off by the minister for the amount of time we're taking to get funds out the door on the basis that we're doing checks to make sure that these businesses really existed and actually did qualify. And then all of a sudden, they're apparently asking councils to try and get the money back. It's been lots of fraud. So everything's haphazard, everything's last minute, everything's too little, too late. And the amount of money that's already been wasted that could have been directed to sectors which would struggle, whereas now we've got a situation where potentially businesses which have made a lot of money out of this period of time could be rewarded with £1,000 per employee that they keep on. It just, none of it's directed towards trying to maximise the positive impact. And I'm not saying the government needs to put a lot more money into it, although we might bear in mind that our economic competitors in the world are doing exactly that. I'm just saying that the money that's out there already should be better focused into areas where it's going to do some good. Aviation is not a declining industry. Aviation is a growing industry. The government was prepared to put billions of pounds of public money into Heathrow for no direct state connect because it saw aviation as being so critical to the UK's economic future. And now the aviation industry is struggling. They're refusing to do anything about that for a much, much lower price, which is actually, I think, one of those classic cognitive fallacies that people tend to go for infrastructure on the grounds to see it as something substantial, is you don't maintain things long term because you see that as being less substantial, and it actually that tends to result in worse economic outcomes. And in the case of, you know, the aviation industry, a lot of this runs to such small margins to begin with. The amount of time it's going to take Britain to recover when every other country in the world has got the systems in place. I think we're witnessing the dying days of UK as being a leading force in the aviation industry, because how are they going to survive throughout all of this?
Yeah. And you said that you've had conversations about support for the aviation industry. As you said, other countries, you know, have taken an approach where they've supported and underpinned, you know, particularly in the short term where, you know, uncertainty is at its highest. I mean, what's your sense that the government has been reluctant to do that? Have you got a kind of reasoned response to that?
I think there were a lot of people all at once asking for money, and I think the antics of people like Branson probably didn't help at the start, where it wasn't quite as bad as it has become.
Yeah,
we're trying to get taxpayers' money, and that probably makes Treasury a bit more resistant. But they need to be less emotionally driven and focus more on the actual economic indicators when it comes to this stuff. And it can't just be a case of, oh, well, we've got a problem with these people, so we're not going to bother sort of funding an entire sector that's important to the country. But, you know, I mean, some of this childishness it goes even further. I mean, at the moment, they're consulting on trying to do away with duty-free, which is worth billions to the sector, you know, at the time when it's already on its hands and knees. Now, why is that? Is it because they're trying to push back on that sector, stop them trying to do quite as much lobbying? Is it because they simply haven't thought this through? I mean, you don't get the sense that anyone has actually got a real handle on the problems that we're currently facing or what it's going to take. And certainly, as a leader of a local authority facing all this, my impression is the government's throwing us on the scrap heap. Why bother with one town? Why bother with one local community when you can focus on others? But it's short-termist, because at the end of the day, when all this public money and all this borrowing has been spent, we're going to actually have to pay it back. And that means if you've lost all your national industries actually performing effectively in the growth areas, how are you going to do that? It's incredibly short-termist.
And you know, we hear a lot about the government's commitment to, you know, to levelling up and to place-based approaches and such. But I mean, what notwithstanding whether, you know, the degree of rhetoric in that rather than reality, which we need to be mindful of. I mean, what would you want, in addition to the sort of, support for the aviation industry, which obviously would have huge effects for your locality, but in addition to that, what else would you want to, would you be calling on the government to be thinking about in terms of supporting, you know, economies like Crawley and others across the country that are having a rough time of it? Are there other things that you particularly notice or that isn't being done or could be done?
There are going to be lots of little things that could be done, but, you know, just think about the amount of money that one single industry is bringing into the area and what it's going to take to try and replace that. Yeah. The reason why I keep pushing on aviation is not because I particularly love the sector, it's because when you look at the knock-on effects to every other bit, that if you can keep that one bit going, you don't then have to have 101 different strategies for dealing with every other economic sector. You know, and there's better money, it hits consumer spending as well. So, you know, absolutely everything in Crawley right now is at risk because there's no deal for aviation. Nothing is going to have that sort of scale. The one thing which probably, you know, the government should consider is revisiting the impacts in terms of benefits cuts over the last 10 years. Because if you're going to have a community which is going to take years to get people back into employment, think of the knock-on effects in terms of consumer spending to all those industries if everyone's going to be living on a pittance. And we know that people suddenly realise how much benefits have been cut over the last 10 years, because when everyone was thinking they were going to have to go off on sick leave at £91 a week, there was absolute horror from most of the community. But I think we just ignored how bad and how weak our social security system is now, and entire communities, through no fault of their own. Just bear in mind, the only reason why my town is struggling right now is the direct consequence of restrictions put in place by the government. The government has a duty to step up and do something about what they've caused.
Yeah, I mean, no, you make a great point and good way to kind of finish, which is about, you know, as you say, lots of places are, you know, are struggling through the pandemic because of, you know, as you say, because of the shock that it's had on places. But there are, you know, there are some places, Crawley being a good example, there are other examples where the particular nature of their economy and how it functions and its dominance by, you know, by one industry almost, you know, when that industry then struggles or goes, you know, turns into a and begins to struggle, then, you know, the effects are very, very large and felt across the locality itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting that our local enterprise partnership named its entire economic regeneration strategy Gatwick 360, so that's having to be revisited.
Yeah, well, we'll keep an eye on what the government has to say and to continue to push questions and issues around some of them that you've raised today. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And finally, I'm now joined by Ben Bradley, MP for Mansfield. Welcome, Ben.
Hi, how are you doing?
So obviously you were elected in 2017, and then you were joined by many more Conservative MPs in 2019 as part of the, well, what was Labour's red wall as it turned blue, which is a kind of interesting kind of perspective in its own right. But I want to start by just getting your thoughts on, you know, how that process, the blue wall, as it were, how does that influence the way that the Conservative Party and obviously the government thinks about issues and questions around levelling up and devolution? Is it more prominent because of the blue wall?
Absolutely, yeah. It was brilliant to see so many of those kind of traditionally Labour working class towns, similar demographics to Mansfield, kind of turning blue in December. And it means that, having been ploughing a fairly lonely furrow for a couple of years trying to raise these issues, you know, now there are a lot of colleagues with similar local things they want to raise and similar viewpoints in terms of their experience of the world. A lot of them actually are from and representative of the areas that they now represent in Parliament, which is great. So a big lobbying effort, particularly around investment in some of those seats, which is absolutely vital. And then groups springing up within the Conservative Party. I've got a group called Blue Collar Conservatives, which is for exactly that purpose, which is pushing levelling up skills and training and all the things that are really important to places like Mansfield.
Yeah, because you mentioned the blue collar kind of group, and also you're a member of the Levelling Up Task Force as well, aren't you? Which is about 60 or so MPs from across the country. So I mean, just say a little bit about that and how that sort of beginning to think about what it wants to do, and then I'd be keen to get your thoughts on, you know, from a Mansfield point of view, what's the Levelling Up agenda for a place like Mansfield? But just say a little bit more about the Levelling Up Task Force and the blue collar group as well.
Yeah, Levelling Up Task Force is backed by a think tank called Onward, and it's something we're trying to do to basically be able to initially to assess the levelling up process, because we've all heard level up, invest, invest. And there's not really been any framework laid out as to how we judge the success or failure of that, or to what the expectation is in terms of what that looks like. So the first thing that the Levelling Up Task Force have done is to lay out a bit of a suggestion as to, you know, what might constitute success. And that's it basically lays out a framework for judging whether people have caught up in terms of the level of investment in you know, disadvantaged parts of the Midlands and the North versus the Southeast, changes in academic attainment, for example, across some of those seats compared to the more affluent places. And we'll lay that out in more detail and proposals over the coming months in terms of specifics, you know, asks, if you like. And Blue Collar, very similar, it is a group that came together a couple of years ago with the view to pushing policy that was pertinent or particularly important to areas like ours, things around law and order, for example. We've been pushing for school funding, we've been pushing for public sector pay rise, which, you know, all of these things fortunately are now government policy, and there are various bits within that that look as well at investment, town centre regeneration, the kind of things that would be hugely important to the Centre for Cities. We had a conference last week where I took the guys from Blue Collar around Mansfield, and we talked about the town centre, around the physical changes that we needed, the marketplace, and you know, what kind of investment and change we'd like to see. So lots and lots of different groups pushing this agenda.
And that's, I suppose, trying to make it, you know, real in a sense, because otherwise, you know, notions of levelling up, they all seem very abstract, and actually the punter on the street, or the, you know, the person in the streets, like, what are you talking about? I worry about X or Y. What are you going to do about that? I mean, I suppose that's part of the agenda, particularly, you know, if you're a politician from the party that is in government. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And I think we get these abstract concepts, don't we, like levelling up, which ultimately is a phrase somebody's just made up somewhere. And we need to try and make it meaningful for people in terms of seeing tangible outcomes, don't we? It's easy to say from a government perspective, we have put X amount of money into Y. But if there's no tangible, visible outcome of that on the ground in constituencies like mine, then it's not worked. So there are elements, you know, around the town centre, around that physical regeneration of buildings and space and changing the use of what we're doing. But then there's the longer term approach as well, which is what we need in terms of genuinely improving the economies of these areas, which is things like job creation and skills and training. And we need to be able to see real tangible outcomes from the money. The constant complaint around every regeneration project that's happened in our neck of the woods is always, well, you had 1.4 million for, you know, doing up Leeming Street last year. Where's that gone? Nobody's noticed that you spent it. Yeah. So we do need to make sure it visibly changes things.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, you've been an MP, in that part of the world for 3 years. But prior to that, I think there was a Labour MP a Labour MPs for the best part of 30 odd years, if I'm right. I mean, how do you, from a political point of view, say, you know, this is the Conservative approach versus, you know, this is the Labour approach? I mean, how do you differentiate that? Is it being better at doing things, or is it doing different things, or is it a combination of both?
I think combination of both. The previous guy was there for 30 years. He'd been the MP for 30 years when I got elected at 27 years old, which was interesting in itself. But Labour goes back to 1918, so 100 years of Labour. And I think the biggest shift for us has been in attitude, to be honest. We've had, and I heard it on the doorsteps in 2017, you know, people were fed up of hearing people moan about what happened in the 80s, and obviously closure of the pits and the industry, and that was hugely problematic for our local economy and for jobs. But actually people want to look forward now. And we've spent 30 years saying how awful it is, and that's not really got us anywhere. So, you know, it is a case of trying to plan ahead, trying to invest in these places. Even under Labour government, these places didn't get a huge amount of money, or we got things that look nice. So, you know, we got a new hospital frontage under the Labour government that now is costing us 14% of our local NHS budget in PFI repayments. So, you know, they did things that looked shiny, didn't work. I think so there's an element of both being more optimistic for the future and investing in things that look forward, but also actually then doing them better in a more cost-effective way, we hope.
Yeah, and I mean, slightly unfair question, but in a sense, you know, levelling up was very much a centrepiece of the election last year. Obviously, the PM, you know, made a big play of it, you know, a commitment to doing it. You know, if you were, you know, kind of marking the card of the government over the last 12 months, obviously, you know, COVID rightly makes us rethink everything in different ways. But I mean, what, as a local MP, satisfied, dissatisfied, frustrated? I mean, how would you sort of lay it out where we currently are?
I think there's some good stuff and some frustrations, obviously. COVID has delayed a lot of things. We had some fairly simple, small-scale projects, you know, junction improvements and bits and pieces that we were on the verge of securing that have been delayed for the last 6 months and you know, having gone, it's coming, and then actually it's been pushed back. You know, constituents get really frustrated. But there's some good stuff too. So, you know, we're talking about town deals and future high street fund, things like that, that have ploughed on throughout, and we've submitted kind of detailed bids now for those investments for future high streets, another one coming for town deals in October. We've had £1 million up front to get started with some physical changes to the town centre in the last week or so. So there's investment there. There's £51 million potentially for Mansfield to do something in our town centre. And then we've had this week, you know, from a longer term shift, obviously we're going to have unemployment issues, but we've seen big changes in terms of the approach to skills and training this week, shift towards further education, and entitlement to level 3 training, which would be great. 70% of adults in my patch haven't got that level 3 qualification, so some really positive stuff that, you know, from a skills perspective, I think that's a bit of a game changer. But we'd like to see, and we need to see in response to COVID, a kind of superpowered leveling up, I suppose, rather than backing away from it, because, you know, voters will remember what we promised them in that 2019 election, and that was more investment.
Yeah, and I suppose the kind of leads on, you know, it's in a sense of the hope or the ambition, aspiration around the, you know, the spending review. Obviously, is, you know, it's up for debate as to the exact shape and nature of it as it currently is, whether it'll be a 1 year or a 3 year, whether it'll be revenue or and with some capital thrown in. But I mean, what are the kind of things that you would be, you know, you'd be looking out for, both from a Mansfield perspective, but also from a, you know, a levelling up task force and blue collar perspective? What would you be looking for?
Yeah, I think we need to be in a position to see that key infrastructure investment, to be honest, and to see that continue. There are lots of grand plans laid out pre-COVID, and obviously the inequalities in terms of both economies, but also people's own lives and opportunities have only grown as a result of the virus. So we can't afford to scale back on that investment, in my view. And you know, when the economy has taken the hit that it has, we're going to have to kind of build and grow our way out of it, as the PM has quite rightly said. So if we're going to see job creation, in particular in my part of the world, when unemployment has already doubled since March, then we're going to need to see that infrastructure investment, whether that is, you know, roads, buildings, hospitals. There was 40 hospitals announced this week, or 48 hospitals. All those things create jobs. We've got a big proposal in the East Midlands around a freeport, which will be thousands of jobs in terms of manufacturing, engineering and kind of technique, future-facing tech jobs, which will be brilliant for our neck of the woods. So we're going to have to see those changes. And as far as I understand, you know, that is the plan, is to kind of supercharge, as I say, as opposed to scale back. I hope that means we'll see more of the kind of local economic investment, more town deal kind of funding, things like that in the future as well. Because, as I say, people are going to want to and expect to see physical changes to the place where they live.
And do you think, I mean, going back to where we started, but do you think, you know, there are, you can be more optimistic about that sort of agenda staying, you know, or those issues staying at the top of the agenda because of, you know, the politics of, you know, the fact that the blue wall is now the blue wall and you know, that formed a significant part of the majority for the government. So, you know, looking after those new voters is obviously, the thing that rightly they ought to be thinking about.
Yeah, quite. I mean, there are 107 new Conservative MPs in 2019 that are largely, not all, but largely from that kind of background, those kind of seats, including a few of us that were left over from before. So it's a big old lobby in the Conservative Party, and the blue collar group, you know, has 120 MPs in it, which is, you know, 10 times as many as the Lib Dems. We should have some influence. And trying to make that case is top of the agenda. So we've seen already, as we got lost in COVID a little bit in the summer, and the PM did his big kind of resetting, growing a way out of it kind of speech, and Rishi Sunak did the same, that, you know, a lot of that resetting, I think, came from that big push from seats like ours to say, look, hang on, I know we've got international crisis, but actually don't forget the core kind of raison d'etre of what this government needs to be about, which is that levelling up. And then we had, you know, the speeches about what investment was going to come, what job support was going to come, and perhaps reset the narrative a little bit. So we have got that lobbying power and that ability to keep it at the top of the list. So far, you know, the PM has been pretty clear that, you know, keeps using the phrase, keeps pushing it out there and saying, you know, we recognise we're probably going to have an even bigger challenge to bring these places up to something like equal with the more affluent parts of the country over the next 4 years. And, you know, absolutely got to be done.
And is it the spending? Is it at the spending review? Obviously, with the uncertainty we've said, but is it at the spending review at some point, you know, this winter, that you would expect some of those plans then to, you know, to become real? Is that the you know, the piece that we should be looking for?
It's hard to predict, isn't it? Because there are lots of things you would like to see. I think we'll probably see some elements of it. I imagine, and I'm only guessing here, but I imagine it will be a shorter term review, just on the basis of, honestly, we do not know where we're going to be 2 years from now, 3 years from now. And we talked about having the ability post Brexit in particular to set a longer term plan, you know, but with coronavirus, I think that's going to be really challenging. So I would imagine we will see a lot of work around job support, a lot of work around job creation, and the kind of COVID recovery things. We might find that more kind of tangible physical investment in that agenda maybe is something for the spring, when we know a bit more about where we are. But it's all guesswork. We don't get told anything any more than you do ahead of these things, to be honest.
Brilliant. Well, Ben, thanks for sharing your guesswork with us. Very much appreciated. Thank you very much, Ben.
Having spoken to my four political guests, where does this leave us? Well, a few things strike me. The first one, clearly and obviously, COVID has had a huge impact on the policy agendas of the two main parties. The capacity to focus on anything else other than COVID is very limited for obvious reasons. And you can see this in the delays to the devolution white paper, the delays to the national infrastructure strategy, to the Green Book revisions, and to the detail of what the levelling up agenda actually means, both for the government and the Conservative Party, but also for the Labour Party. Having said that, and this is my second observation, and this was perfectly illustrated by Peter and Abby, local authorities, cities and towns across the country are getting on with helping their places cope with and recover from COVID. And they've been doing this with very limited resources and very limited powers, a long-standing issue about the underfunded, under-empowered nature of local authorities in the UK. So imagine what they could do and achieve if they were properly funded and empowered. And in fact, if we are to make real the levelling up agenda, it will have to be done by empowering and resourcing our local authorities more effectively and to a larger extent than they currently are. And my third reflection is that when you get into the detail of what cities and towns across the country need to improve their places, to make them more prosperous for the people who live and work there, and how national politicians talk about levelling up, there is a great degree of consensus and similarity between the parties. The differences expressed by local and by national politicians are more often driven by the particular needs of a place rather than the political party they belong to. I think this is encouraging. It gives us a good chance of building a policy agenda around levelling up that straddles the two main political parties. And on that hopeful note, I'd like to thank my guests, Bridget, Peter, Abby and Ben, for being part of City Talks. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.